Welcome to Health Media Now with award-winning author and host Denise Messenger for a lifetime of health empowerment. Live by being in the pink, meaning P stands for being persistent, I stands for using your intuition, N stands for networking, and K stands for obtaining knowledge. Preserve and protect your health by listening live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our guests entertain and share cutting-edge information. They share with you what may have taken years to achieve through experience in their field. Become inspired and motivated. Reach your full potential with fascinating tips and products. Receive a lifetime of benefits from authors, doctors, practitioners, healthcare providers, and learn about exciting new products. You asked for it, and we deliver. Now, here's your host, Denise Messenger.
Hello, listeners. Today is October 1st, 2014. I can't believe how fast the year has gone. We've got a great show today. My very special guest is Ernie Vecchio. He's the author of a wonderful book, which we'll get into a little bit later. He's also a trauma psychologist. And we're going to talk about TED. I don't know how many of you have heard about this, but it's a type trait ego dysfunction, which is in the lines of personality disorder. And it's of great interest to me, and I'm sure it will be of great interest to you. So now let's bring Ernie onto our show. Hello, Ernie.
Hey, Denise. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great.
Well, let's start our program out. I want you to tell the audience how you got on the path that you're on today.
Well, as you said in the opening, I am a rehabilitation psychologist, a trauma psychologist, and I didn't realize at the time that I was getting into the field what a profound experience it was going to be to work with people undergoing extreme trauma, because certainly when you're training to be a psychologist, you're not trained to put the egg back together when it breaks, you know. And a lot of the cases that I was seeing at the time that I began my career was like that. I mean, that the contents of the egg was laying on the floor in front of me in a puddle, and the shell of the individual was broken, and I wasn't trained to put the shell back together. And I discovered over time that that wasn't really my goal. The goal was to transfer the contents of that egg into another container, and that ended up becoming a process of learning and growing about the human condition. And so, first of all, kind of understanding what the contents of that egg represented, and it was like the soul and spirit, I think, of the person. But so, long story short, I stumbled into the trauma field after working in the school system and working in the prison system, and I'm so glad I did, because it absolutely changed my life to work with adversity at that level. It really changed the whole path of my career.
How did you get involved in the prison system?
Well, I just started out. I started out working with juvenile delinquents and hardcore criminals because I used to be one. I used to be a juvenile delinquent. I was a child of the state, and I've had my own adversity.
I was
raised in an orphanage, and so I started out in life in kind of a tough spot, and so I was comfortable with that population, because that's kind of where I started. But as I began to grow as an individual and as a professional, that changed inside of me, and it was a matter of geography. I met my wife, my sweetheart at the time, in college, and I ended up moving to her hometown, which I ended up going into a rehabilitation hospital because of that move, and the rest of it's kind of history. But it was kind of by accident on purpose. That's what I say. It was accidentally on purpose.
It just goes to show you how your childhood doesn't necessarily have to define you if it's been a negative experience.
Absolutely. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. That's one of the reasons why I'm talking about this. I'm sure that your listeners haven't heard of TED because this is my label. This is my baby. Nobody's talking about personality disorder at the level that I'm talking about it. And the reason why is because they think of it as the extreme, this business of personality disorder, when in truth, everybody walking around has got glitches in their personality. And what trauma has taught me, and I think you've had an experience with this as well, with your own trauma, it brings out the best and worst of who we are, adversity. And so,
so
what we have to sort out as human beings is what to do with the worst that it brings out. And what is that? What is that glitch? What is that weakness in our armor? What are we supposed to do with that when it happens? And people that wake up, I think, as a result of adversity, tend to do something with that wake-up moment. Mm-hmm. But not everybody does. Not everybody does, you know. It varies. But yeah, I teach all the time.
Why?
Well, I have a thought for that. I think people that have a close relationship with their suffering are inherently spiritually inclined people, and because that's my definition of that's my concept of spirituality, which is the pursuit and understanding of adversity and suffering. So people that are versus religious, the difference is, at least in my experience, is religious people spend their whole lives trying not to go to hell, and spiritual people have already been there. So I think that so spiritual people have a close relationship with suffering, first their own suffering and then the suffering of others. And if they wake up to that, in fact, it turns out to be a gift if they wake up to it. And many of those same people, those same people become nurses and doctors and helpers of all sorts. So I think the spiritual word for that is empathic. I think that there's an empathic component to people who take their adversity and make something special out of it. Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Okay.
Give us an example.
In what respect?
The spiritual side.
Okay. You mean talk about what aspect? I mean, what question are you asking me?
Well, what makes a spiritual person more successful in waking up than a religious person?
Okay. Well, I don't want to say religious. Just how about just a spiritual person versus non-spiritual person? I think what happens is that adversity, at least in my experience of it, is it does something to the ego, to the human ego, that most of us don't have a concept of until we're in the middle of it. So first, let's talk about what ego is. And let's first of all talk about what ego is. Most people think of ego as either being large and grandiose or small and deflated and inferior. When in actuality, the human ego is more like an onion. And there's layers and layers of defense mechanisms between the ego and the outside world. And so what I've witnessed in working with trauma is that if you came in off the street to talk to me about going through a divorce, or you lost your job, or you're going through some kind of a external kind of problem, you may let me get down one or two layers of that onion, but you're not going to let me get to the core of who you are. If I cut off your legs, if I give you, if I tell you you have cancer, it cuts through all layers, all the layers, to the core of who you are. Well, in that moment. And it's a wake-up possibility. A bunch of those layers fall away. In other words, all the things you worried about, all the things you fretted over, all the fears, all the anxieties all the things you thought were important, they just kind of fall away. Now it's, I wish I had my legs back. I wish I didn't have this diagnosis. And so I think spiritual people take that moment and do something with it, because over a period of time, the ego closes back up. So in other words, it's like an opening happens because of the trauma. So you can imagine a shunt being driven through that onion, through all those layers. Well, over time, that shunt is pulled out and the onion closes back up. So it's an opportunity in time and an opportunity in the person's life to keep that moment, that realization open. I guess the word spiritually would be, it's a moment of presence. And if they decide to stay present with their pain and suffering, then they will grow from it. If they decide to go absent again, which is go back into their head and into their fears and their worries, then they're not going to probably grow from the experience.
Mm.
And it's going to be more difficult for them. And at least that's been my experience with it. And and so, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but...
Well, I guess when you talked about an individual may decide to be absent, would that fall under denial?
Yeah, certainly. That's part of what it means to be absent, but denial is the psychology of dealing with something. When I'm talking about absent, I'm saying that you're trapped in your head and you're not in your body at all. Presence means being in your body, fully connected to your senses. You're mindful when you're in your body. When you're in your head, you're not mindful. You're just cognitive and intellectual and whatever. You're trying to sort out whatever's going on in your brain. Yeah, yeah. Mindfulness includes the body. Yeah. So what happens to a paraplegic, for example, who's paralyzed from the neck down? They ask the question, if I'm not this body, then who am I? If I'm not this body, then what am I?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they have to contend with. And they begin to discover that they are so much more than they ever imagined when they look beyond their bodies, you see. And it becomes a profound experience, and it's so different with each individual, Denise. I mean, nobody gets to that place of awareness the same way. Everybody does it uniquely their own way, because it's built upon their own patterns, their own histories, their own, you know, glitches in their armor, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody kind of gets, it's their own kind of journey, which is what makes it kind of fun. I feel a little bit like Indiana Jones when I was doing this, because I was going on this journey with them, and it was almost like going through trap doors and dodging, going down for the diamonds and the rubies, if you will, and going through all of these tests and trials and holding their hand along the way. It was quite an adventure to do that.
Oh, it had to be.
And it changed me forever. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It changed me and grew me forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's talk about type trait ego dysfunction then.
Okay. Yeah. What I wanted to bring to into awareness on this business of type trait ego dysfunction is that there's a lot of stuff going on in the culture that we're struggling with the violence and the headlines and whatever, and we're pointing our finger at everybody and each other, and we're not looking at the precursor or the dynamic that sets this up. And the dynamic that sets this up is that I've witnessed between, I see it's like 1985 up until the present, I'm going to say 1980 up until the present. There's a shift in the culture where we move from kind of a guilt orientation to a more shame-based orientation. And so what began to happen is we began to start shaming one another at a high level. And the difference between guilt and shame is so unique that people don't think about it. They think of it being very similar. But guilt is, I made a mistake, and shame is, I am a mistake. And so the compensation for guilt in the culture forever has been religion and religiosity. The compensation for shame is narcissism, which is an enormous amount of compensation that's built on a very fragile, insecure ground. And so we have two or three generations of people, young people in particular, that are being raised in this energy, if you will, this shame-based orientation. And it begins with type trait ego dysfunction. And what that is, basically, type means that they have difficulty with their own self-assessment, and trait means that they have difficulty with interpersonal connections and interpersonal relationships. These are the dynamics that set up personality disorder. If you've got trouble in both of those areas, one or both of those areas, you will have personality disorder. And as you can see, all of us kind of start out there. All of us kind of start out working that out at some level. So what I want the lay public to know is that there was a time in the culture when you, this was preventable. You could go to see a psychologist, and they could literally take an X-ray of the insides of this individual through different types of testing and whatever, and then mm-hmm. you could find the character disorder and the characterological problems early, and they could be treated and with counseling and psychotherapy and whatever. And it seems like we've gotten away from that. We've gotten away from the art of doing that, and we certainly have gotten away from the habit of doing that. And so now we have, mm-hmm. like I said, two or three generations of kids that are growing up without that kind of inner hygiene, if you will. They have no inner connection to themselves, no sense of who they are. And they're kind of groping, and as a result of that, you've got the precursor to this dysfunction that I'm describing to you. And all you got to do to see.
How does narcissism fit into this sense of who you are?
Because the narcissistic personality is basically an illusion. It's an exaggerated sense of self that's built upon a false reflection, and so that false reflection and the inability to is built on the idea that you cannot see your own reflection. You see, the only way you can see your reflection is through another human being, and if you are cut off from people, then you can't use people as mirrors. And so therefore you're stuck in your head. You're trapped in your head with your own sense of self. And without that reflective capability, then you're in trouble, you see. And that's the key of narcissism, is they're stuck on their own reflection without the capacity, to see themselves. So, I mean, the only purpose that people serve to that personality is for them to be their audience, you know, to be someone who, you know, supports everything they say and do, and they're not there as a mirror, so to speak.
Oh, interesting. Ooh, that's pretty heavy.
Yeah. It's a lot. But I'm bringing it out to the public because I have been hearing for the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or more, is these occurrences happen in the culture, and everybody says, you know, they point the finger at the gun problem, they point the finger at the mental health problem. When in actuality, it's a cultural issue, and many of us could be involved in this experience. In other words, we're all involved in the shaping and the forming of our young people's sense of self and sense of character, and so it's a big issue. It's a big issue. And what drives this home to me, what makes it special to bring out to me is that, and you know this from your own experience, is that these same people can't handle adversity at all. We have the highest amount of PTSD in these past 2 or 3 wars than any other time in history. We have the highest amount of anxiety and depression and PTSD in the United States, just based upon normal cultural trauma, and people aren't coming out of it very resilient. We've got a culture that is really kind of lost the capacity to make a distinction between real and imagined fear. And that is a low level degree of paranoia. So I have answers, I guess is what I'm saying, to some of these questions that somebody doesn't seem to have answers for, like why we're buying so many guns and why is there so much craziness going on with our young people. I mean, I actually have valid answers for this, but it still takes personal responsibility for all of us to step up and say, well, you know, we're, instead of pointing the finger, we need to realize that we're all kind of in this together, and we all could make a difference. But we first have got to identify how to do that, and so it's complex.
What would be the shift in our culture?
Well, Well, let's talk about cancer for a second, since that's a since that's near and dear to your heart. If you get the diagnosis that you have a tumor, or if you find out that you have a tumor, one of the first things that happens is you want to find out whether or not it's benign or not. Well, personality disorder is a tumor. Type 2 ego dysfunction is a tumor. It can be identified and it can be found if you bother to go and have yourself checked out. And this is what I'm trying to say. This capability, this art, because it is more of an art than it is a science, of evaluating people's inner lives, is something that psychology used to do, but we've gotten away from it, drastically gotten away from it. And so there's fewer people doing it, and I think that's part of it. School systems around the country have decided to hire school psychologists in the systems. They're no longer using outside consultants. And so as a result, many of the school psychologists are psychometricians. They're not psychologists. They don't have the depth of clinical practice. They don't have the depth of working with patient after patient of all different diverse populations. All these school psychologists do is just psychometrics. So diagnosis, or the process of diagnosis, has been lost, you see, in the schools. So the short answer to your question is prevention is having your child evaluated early and paying attention to those evaluations and then building in a plan to offset what you discover.
For what age?
Junior high, no later than junior high school, because that's when personality is formed between birth and six. And then, so in other words, it's like a piece of clay between birth and six. From six to 12, it becomes a hard structure, and then from 12 up on, it becomes a fixed set of patterns and beliefs and whatever. So and again, what happens if you undergo adversity is it cracks that container, and you've got to reinvent who you think you are. Well, the cracking of that container is breaking the ego down to its rawest form, and that literally is And so one of the things I asked myself early in my career is, do we have to have a tree fall on us? Do we have to be told that we have cancer to wake up to what's really most important here? And that is to have an inner life, to have a connection to our inner world, and how important that is as we do our day-to-day lives. I mean, it's invaluable to be connected internally to yourself, and it goes ignored in the culture until you get some kind of adversity, some kind of pain or whatever. And so we can predict now. We can evaluate children and adults, for that matter, and know exactly where they're going internally, what they're doing, what the blocks are, what the problems are. And it isn't all about passing out pills, which is kind of what the culture is doing. We're passing out pills at such a high level that we're missing the forest for the trees on some of this. You can't give somebody a pill for ego dysfunction.
So how do you take a narcissistic individual who probably has established that fixed pattern from the time they were 12 and turn them around?
Well, you're not going to turn them around until a two before hits them between the eyes. Narcissism is a big problem in our culture, and I think the success rate in personality disorder in general is, I think, 3-8% of them are changed by psychotherapy.
Really?
Yeah, pretty much any personality disorder, which is why they're giving everybody pills instead of doing psychotherapy. They're just passing out pills. The success rate on working with personality disorder is very, very low, which is why it's very critical to get these people early. And so imagine we have two or three generations now of ego dysfunction in the culture. But the only time we pay any attention to them is in the extreme, is when they have an extreme break, and then we call it psychotic, and then we start pointing fingers at who's to blame. But it really goes back to the point that the best solution to these things is prevention, and prevention is possible. There are steps to take to prevent this kind of detachment for this kind of dysfunction. And we've mm-hmm. gotten so far away. We've gotten so far away from it now. It's kind of sad. So I'm trying with my effort to bring attention to it. But ironically, kind of like you, it's after my work with trauma and adversity that I become aware of this. That I too was asking the question, and mm-hmm. I think you asked this in your book, why is it some people can get bad news and turn it into something special, and some people get bad news and can't do anything with it? Well, the mm-hmm. honest answer is pre-morbid adjustment. Pre-morbid adjustment means where they were before they got the news. I can give you an example. I got two amputees, two 16-year-old boys that were amputees. One of them had climbed a telephone pole and got a hold of a live electrical wire and blew his legs off above the knee. I know, it's horrible. The other child was in a car accident. He jumped out of the vehicle going over an embankment, and the door slammed on his legs. He's also a double amputee. I got both of these kids sitting in front of me. One of them mm-hmm. is getting his GED and going on to college. The other one is taking alcohol and drugs, and he's suicidal. What sets these two kids apart? Where they were before they lost their legs. And I'm telling you that I can tell you where they were before they lost their legs. I have a way of taking a picture of their guts in such a way that I can tell you where they were before they lost their legs.
Oh, my word.
And I'm talking. And of course, I'm talking internally where they were.
Sure.
And so this is the point. This capability is there, but it is an art that the culture has forgotten about and gotten away from at such mm-hmm. a high level that now it's epidemic. Personality disorder is epidemic in this culture at a high level. Mm-hmm. And so me doing this show with you and me talking on my show is partly to bring this to people's attention, but also it isn't as horrible and awful as it sounds, this business of taking a look at your inner life. It's actually mm-hmm. quite an adventure. It's quite an adventure to do that. And
how is that done?
To take a picture of your inner life?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have exercises and different things that I put people through. It really just depends upon the person. I kind of meet them where they are. But I mean, I have projective instruments and projective tests that I use that psychology has as a profession. But I also have some exercises and some things that I have come up with. But a lot of dreams, I do a lot of dream work with folks as well, which is quite revealing. But when you're talking about children, you're limited on what techniques you can use.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to also know what you're looking for, Denise. That's very important. And it takes thousands of administrations, literally thousands of administrations of these instruments to know how to use them and use them proficiently and to use them responsibly. And that's what we have gotten away from, it seems, as a culture and as a profession. Yeah.
Listeners, if you've just joined in, we're talking with Ernie Vecchio.
Vecchio, yes.
Vecchio.
Yes.
And those Italian names.
I know.
He's a trauma psychologist, and we're talking about type trait ego dysfunction. Why don't you tell the listeners about your book, the title of your book, and why you wrote it?
Well, I've got a couple books that I've written. The Soul's Intent is the book that I wrote a couple years ago that I think I told you before that has to do with a bunch of dream content that I used in about 200 of my patients. I've treated 10,000 patients in my career, Denise, and about 6,000 of those I've been intimately involved with their recovery. So I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been doing this a long time. And so The Soul's Intent came out of a lot of the dream content of my patients. And I wrote it in such a way that the ego, the human ego, was discussing with the soul how to handle adversity, how to achieve presence, how to recover from trauma. And so that's what The Soul's Intent's about.
Okay.
I read another book called The Astonishing Dream of Job, And I did that because I discovered that many of the people coming into my hospital were having a spiritual crisis. It didn't make any difference whether they were Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, agnostic, atheist. It didn't seem to matter. They were all in some kind of a spiritual crisis. And so I took the Job story, and I took it over to Belize with me for a couple months, and I interpreted the entire 42 chapters as having a dream. And so the name of the book is The Astonishing Dream of Job, and it turns out that all 10,000 of my patients went through the same thing Job went through. So the Job story is about a cathartic awakening based upon trauma. And so it really tells us how to suffer. The Job story actually tells us how to suffer. There's actually a way to suffer that's healthy. And it's actually in the story. So those are the two books. And then I have another one that's tied to Gift of Compassion therapy. So I have a whole therapy around this that came out of my work.
When you find all the time to write all these books?
Well, it's been over the past 8 years that I've written these books. My last book was in 2012, I guess. Yeah, so it's been 2 years ago, which was the Job book. The Soul's Intent was written a couple years before that. Yeah, so I've kind of slowed down on the writing. I've written a couple textbooks on gifted compassionate therapy. And my website, which is about intentional guided evolution, I came up with that language because what I discovered was that, and I said this to you off the air, that when I was dealing with people's traumas, something inside of them was pulling them into the present in spite of their ego's resistance to that. And so I had to figure out what that something was, and so I speak about that in my work, and that's literally what I teach people. So intentional guided evolution means growing on purpose. Just a fancy way of saying growing on purpose, and in this case, growing from adversity, and really putting the heart is the compass. Because another thing that I left out when I was talking about type trait ego dysfunction is that what happened in the 80s, besides the shift from guilt to shame, is we substituted the ego as the default compass in the culture. And so, which means we've kind of removed the human heart as the compass. And so what I do in my work is put people back in touch with that heart-centered approach versus egoic approach. And so that's the key of what...
There's in our society today, we're being desensitized on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Yes, it's a problem. It's a problem, and that's part of what personality disorder is a detachment from one's own humanity, and that desensitization lays the groundwork for us to go inside ourselves. And again, without reflecting, we can't see what we're doing inside ourselves, and so we're really just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. And so. The baby boomers, which I'm in that generation. You know, we've got this wonderful wealth of wisdom out here, but we don't have a lot of young people looking to our senior citizens for guidance. And this is an issue that when you consider there's 84,000 plus teenagers in this country, which far exceeds the boomer population, they outnumber us by that much. And you saw what the boomer generation did, all the wonderful things they did and all the horrific things they did. They were a powerful force to be dealt with. Well, this group of young people is lost. They're totally clueless. And it's what's kind of scary is these are the leaders of our future, and these are the people that are going to be in charge of our culture. And they are detached, desensitized, dysfunctional in many respects. And so, again, this is why I'm trying to bring this to people's awareness, because it is...
You almost wonder if it's going to take a huge human world event to change things.
Well, if I take my career, it will take a trauma. It will take a major shift. But and we've already undergone some of this with the collapsing of the economy and with the terrorist stuff that's happening. But the interesting part about it, though, Denise, is that we become afraid of being afraid, and that is a problem, because fear actually has a function. And when you can't tell real fear from imagined fear, you're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And I joke with people all the time and tell them that we forgot the story of the three little pigs, because the answer to much of this is in the three little pigs. That the straw sticks to bricks that they run to in those houses.
Mm-hmm.
This is the developmental understanding of what to do with fear. And so we've become a culture of people living in houses of straw and sticks. And very few of us are living in brick homes, which is why we're buying so many weapons. And so it's an internal problem. It's an internal problem. You don't get security by going out and buying 1,000 guns. You get security internally, and if you don't have it, then, again, you're stuck. I mean, look at what we used to do when we were kids, at least what I used to do when we were kids. We used to get under the desk in case of atomic war.
Mm-hmm.
And how funny is that today? We used to get under the desk. And so it was this illusion of security, an illusion of safety.
Those were drills that they had the children do.
Yeah. Do you remember that? And how insane is that? I mean, mm-hmm. if an atomic bomb mm-hmm. goes off, you would turn to dust. I don't think getting under the desk would make any difference. And so it's the same thing that we're doing today. We're giving people the illusion of security,
mm-hmm.
and we're looking outside for it rather than inside for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to find it inside ourselves. And this is this is fertile ground for type trait ego dysfunction, or this is fertile ground for personality dysfunction. And that's what we are witnessing. That's what we're experiencing. And
I read the statistics that 1 out of 3 has some form of disorder,
yes.
mental disorder.
It's probably
one out
even
of
higher.
Three.
Yeah,
you think?
It's probably even higher. Yeah. Yeah, well, when you consider that statistic is coming from the Mental Health Association, those are the people that have been identified. The general population is walking around with an enormous amount of dysfunction disorder.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is look at general physicians and ask them how many antidepressants they're passing out and how many anti-anxiety medicines they're passing out. It's an enormous amount.
Scary.
So we are a medicated society. Well, what are we medicating? Well, we're medicating fear. And depression, if you want to make a pie called depression, there are two ingredients in that pie. It's fear and anger.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to make paranoia, it's fear and guilt. Well, if you're going to make self-loathing and self-hatred, it would be fear and shame. So these conditions that we all walk around with a little bit of this. Every one of us has this in our personality at some level. We all learn how to compensate and to move on in spite of it and grow hopefully mm-hmm. from it. But we become more and more a pill-based culture, and addictions at a high level. It's
wonderful.
Yeah,
it's just terrible.
But the good news is that it doesn't have to stay this way. That there actually is a way to prevent it. And even if you're involved in hearing this radio show, you don't have to stay stuck in your stuff. You know,
mm-hmm,
you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old. What is the old story? Mirror, mirror on the wall. You know, all
mm-hmm.
you have to do is look in the mirror and be honest with yourself. The cool thing about being present, having a spiritual connection or a spiritual ground to something larger than yourself, is that
mm-hmm.
You can't do self-deception anymore. That's the cool
mm-hmm.
thing about adversity. Adversity that you think puts us in touch with that we can't do self-deception anymore, that we have to kind of be honest with ourselves about who we
mm-hmm.
are and why we are. Yeah. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that I'm saying to people, we need to take a hard look at ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I in fact can't imagine life any other way, because that's just who I've always been. I mean, when I was 9 years old, Denise, I looked up at the sky and I said, God, if you exist, you've got a sick sense of humor. And Satan, if you exist, sign me up. I'm in, you know. And people used to ask me later on in my life if I believed in the devil. And I said, I was born in hell, never met the guy, but I saw God all over the place. So I think that's what I mean about spiritual. I was 9 years old, and I was having that kind of self-reflective moment. I mean, come on. I mean, what are nine-year-olds reflecting about today? I mean, I had the time to have that kind of self-reflective moment, and I was in an orphanage at the time.
They're texting.
Not
even having conversations face-to-face any longer.
Oh, absolutely. It's crazy. It really is crazy. So this is my little effort, my little tiny voice in the distance to say to the world that's listening that if you care about your young people, if you want answers to some of these questions that the media doesn't seem to be answering about violence, about guns, about why our kids seem to be so lost, I have some valid answers for this, but I also have some valid solutions as well. And yes, it's a process, and yes, there isn't a magic pill for any of it. It is focused attention. It is responsibility. It's all those things. But this is part of the problem. We lack a lot of integrity in some of this stuff. And this is, I'm trying to, in my final years in my profession, to kind of bring some integrity back to this. It's been very painful for me to come out of the hospital. I came out of the hospital in 2006, Denise, and I was in my own world. I spent 30 years on the unconscious of suffering people. It was very awakening for me to come out into the culture and see how many people are asleep. They've got their legs, they've got their spinal cord, they've got their vision, they're not head injured, they're not traumatized, but yet they are asleep in their lives at such a level that I could not believe. And so it blew me away when I came out and saw that. Since 2006, I've been trying to say to people, wow, you know, life is so much more profound than this. People ask me all the time, what's the benefit of the work of working with me? I say, well, what if I tell you that I can make the blues bluer and the greens greener? Would you want to come and talk to me? Because that literally is the result of waking up and finding some meaning and purpose in your life, just beyond survival, just basic day-to-day survival, which is what a lot of people are stuck in.
Right. Well, you know, if you can change one life at a time,
then slowly
you can raise the level of consciousness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I feel like I spent a career doing it, but I'm more focused now in a little bit of a different direction. Yeah, but I'm not working with trauma cases anymore. Now I'm doing more life coaching, more teaching, mentoring, and in fact, a lot of the people in my community consider me a therapist. So I work with a lot of people that are in their own work, growing and mentoring which is a lot of fun. Yeah.
No, that's a great thing to do.
And you're in California, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to do something in California. I haven't had a chance to come out there yet, but I'd love to come out there and do something. But I tell people all the time that I care about this so much that if you just pay my room and board, I'll come and speak. I care about what I've learned. I mean, I care so much about what I've learned about adversity and people coming back from trauma that I want to share it with other people. It's so much more than I'm able to talk about in this brief time with you. It is a lot of stuff that is quite valuable to talk about. And so, yeah.
We'll definitely have to maybe figure something out next year.
Yeah, I'd love to do something like that because I'm making that offer on my radio show all the time and I've gone around this part of the country, but I haven't been on the West Coast hardly at all. So I'd love to come out there and do something. It'd be fabulous.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about cultural distortion, and that's in relation to the healthy compassion side of people versus the unhealthy.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I discovered, and this is so profound, Denise, and I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you this, but one of the things that you do as a psychologist is you do intelligence testing. When you do a psychological examination of somebody, you tend to want to know what their intellect is. Well, one of the one of the vocabulary words on the intelligence test is compassion. I discovered in working with severe trauma that there was a theme of how we were defining compassion in this culture. And again, I'm talking 10,000 patients, so I think it's enough of a sample to say that this is valid. Probably about 72-73% of them define compassion as sacrifice and martyrdom. And that, of course, comes out of the Christian concept that Christ died for us versus died with us. And so their definition of compassion was to suffer for another human being, just like Christ. When in actuality, compassion means to suffer with. Now, what's profound about that distortion, is that it doesn't sound like that big of a deal, suffering for versus suffering with. Well, suffering for is victim. Suffering with is transformation. Suffering with this transformation. So we have got a, beside the ego being made the default compass in the past 20 some odd years, we've also got the concept of compassion distorted. We think it means to suffer for, to carry suffering for others. And you see this in the helping profession when they talk about burnout. Yeah, well, and you see it in the helping profession when they talk about burnout. Doctors have this a lot, and nurses have it. It's called compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been doing this for 100 years. I've never felt 1 ounce of burnout in what I do. Not a day of burnout, ever. That's because I know what compassion is. I suffer with my patients. I don't suffer for them. Mm-hmm. And so that distortion is a big deal. And so, again, back to the extreme examples in the culture, what are these people doing when they go out and commit these horrendous crimes? They then turn the gun on themselves. You will not know me in life, but you will know me in death. So the martyrdom and sacrifice is there, you see, even in the examples. And so that cultural distortion of compassion and the ego is the default compass. Those are two big things that that came through. And it didn't seem to matter what belief system people were under, whether it, like I said, whether it was Christian or non-Christian or religious or non-religious, they all seemed to have this this idea that that they've been living the wrong kind of life and they're being punished. And that's what why the adversity happened to them. Yeah, but have you not experienced that in working with other cancer patients, that they go through a period of why me, and it must be something that I brought on myself? I mean, because that's kind of a normal thing. In grief.
Well, there's a pattern where from the moment of diagnosis, you go into denial. It's a subconscious thing. Some people come out of it within 4 months. Some come out of it within 6. The problem with it is if they have a severe case, they're in denial and making choices on treatment protocols becomes very difficult for them. They typically will ask somebody else to make those decisions for them.
Yes.
And that's when a lot of times it doesn't turn out well.
I can see that. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, what you're saying, denial, and certainly, you know, it's kind of like the grief process. You know, you go through, what is it, shock, anger, disbelief. I forget the 5 stages of grief. But I think that the point is that somewhere in that moment of realigning how you think and how you feel about what you're experiencing, you're looking up at the sky and going, why me? And I found it quite curious that a lot of people blame themselves or punish themselves in some way for living the wrong kind of life and or for not being stronger or not being better people. I just thought that was a fascinating thing. And so they said, and I said to them, I said, well, you know, God actually has 2 faces. And they go, really? I said, well, is it the God of the Old Testament, God of the New Testament? Which God are you talking to? You know, and clearly they were talking to the God of the Old Testament. And so, again, that's of course, I am in that area of the country where the Bible Belt is quite huge. So there's a lot of religion where I am. But I thought it was curious that it really was across all different belief systems. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just in one.
And it's something that I say a lot. We have a choice. We can choose mm-hmm. something negative, or we can choose something positive to think
Absolutely.
About and to work on. It's
Absolutely.
Either or. It's not mm-hmm. really, you know, there really isn't any middle ground there.
Right.
Well,
right.
We have run out of time. This has been a stimulating conversation. I think our listeners are just amazed with our interview today. Again, why don't you tell the listeners where your website is, the name of your books, and your program, and how they can reach you.
Okay. The name on my website is just my name. It's ErnieVeccio.com. And you can contact me through there. Plus, I'm also on Blog Talk as well, and the name of my show is The Soul's Intent. It's Monday nights at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and that's the way you reach me. And I, like I said, I'm doing a fair amount of coaching and mentoring of people that are doing spiritual work, but I'm also trying to talk about adversity and talk about personality problems and dysfunction in the culture, because it's, I won't say it's near and dear to my heart, but I'm just getting tired of seeing the headlines every day. And
sure.
Everybody's saying, you know, what's the answer? What's the answer? Well, I actually have some valid answers. I don't have a lot of people that are reaching out to me for those answers, but I think I wrote CNN, and I wrote some people last year with some answers. And again, it's like I'm sure I'm a needle in a haystack of people that are responding. So
you need to get yourself a publicist.
It's that's part of one of my weaknesses. Maybe you can identify with this, but as many books as I have written and stuff, I don't have the personality. Probably the hardest part is the whole self-promoting piece. I'm not real fond of self-promotion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little uncomfortable with it. But this is my stab at that. What little bit of radio I do and what little bit of writing I do is my effort at self-promoting. So.
Well, in closing, Ernie, I just want to tell you are a gift.
Well, thank you so much, Denise, and so are you. I mean, I said off the air to you that I thought we had a connection because of your relationship with adversity in your own life and how you've overcome it and what you're doing with that experience. It's no different than what I'm doing, my adversities and my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you and I both are kind of trying to give it away now and trying to share it with other people. And that's I say all the time that what is self-esteem and self-worth? You're not supposed to put it in a coffee can and bury it out back. You're supposed to share it with others.
That's right. That's right.
And so that's kind of what I think
about. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us today. Take care.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, please tune in again for our show in 2 weeks' time. I want to thank you all for supporting our show. And for learning, that's what this is all about. Take care, be well. Bye-bye.
We celebrate our listeners worldwide and invite you to contact Denise at www.healthmedianow.com with any questions you may have, and follow her on Twitter at Health Media Now and Facebook at Health Media Now. For those interested in an advertising campaign on her show, contact Lisa at KnowledgeWorksPub.com. Be sure to visit GotCancerNowWhat.com for information on Denise Messenger's award-winning book, Got Cancer, Now What?
Listeners, just want to remind you that the entire contents of this radio show is based upon the opinions of Denise and her guest. It's not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional of your choice. And it's not intended as medical advice. We're sharing information, knowledge from our guest and our community. We encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional of your choice. Thank you, and bye-bye.